Hello and welcome to another episode of Transformational Blueprints, where we try to put a dent in the large number of transformation programs that fail. Hosted by me, Mario Michaels, founder and director of Synaxia Group. On this series, we will bring you unique insights drawn from first-hand experience from some of the most high-profile architecture and transformation leaders across the globe. Topics told in order to share knowledge, experiences, and ideas to inspire, innovate, and give back to the architecture community. So grab a coffee, sit back, and relax. Welcome, everybody. Today, we're going to be talking to Steve Judd about the architecture of cloud computing. For those of you that don't know, Steve has worked in the tech industry for over 30 years, starting as a mainframe developer before moving on to Lotus Notes and then Java application development and architecture. The last decade, Steve has focused on cloud architecture and specifically Kubernetes. And in his current role as technical director at Vanafi Jetstack Consult, he combines tech thought leadership with platform engineering and advisory. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Brilliant. Good to be here.
Thank you very much. So we always like to start with a bit of, just to give a bit of context, a bit of background about yourself and your career and how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, so I started work for Cadbury's straight out of university, doing COBOL and assembler and other such exciting things on mainframes for a few years. Saw the light, moved over onto a very young PC-based industry at the time, doing all sorts of different types of development. And then, yeah, I guess I moved around quite a bit, moved to London, did some work for some investment banks on Lotus Notes, and then joined the initial dot-com revolution. That was right. our first dot-com bubble, shall we say, which was kind of an interesting roller coaster. Let's just leave it at that. But after that, I moved over. That's when Java kicked off. So I moved into doing Java application development, moved into doing more architecture, application architecture work, especially back-end APIs. Did a load of work for various telecoms companies for quite a few years. And then probably about 10 years ago, I moved over into kind of more consulting type work. So mostly I've worked for like boutique consultancies. So Jetstack being the latest. Initially it was Open Credo with a bit of a stint with PA Consulting in the middle. But it was that I kind of, yeah, 10 years ago is when Kubernetes kind of came out. Docker was really kicking off, and it just looked like a really exciting part of the industry to be in. You know, a lot of greenfield, a lot of patterns to be discovered, mistakes to be made, best practices to be uncovered, and so on. So I've really spent the last 10 years doing what I would call cloud architecture.
Okay, very good. So you've had that mix of sort of industry, what I call commerce and industry, and then consultancy. So you would have come across a lot of architects, whether they were peers, whether they were clients, whether they were sort of direct reports into you, and we'll go on into your leadership career in a moment. So what do you think makes a great architect in today's world then?
Experience. Okay. I think years ago I read this phrase and I thought, oh, that's it. I really liked it. It was strong opinions loosely held. So okay. I think as an architect, you do need to have an opinion and probably quite a strong opinion, but equally you should be prepared to kind of lose that opinion in the face of compelling arguments.
Yep.
And I, you know, certainly the best architects that I've worked with or come across are those sorts of people. You know, they're willing to listen to a variety of points of view, assess the arguments and perhaps change the way that they do things. I think it's not maybe the commonest skill, and certainly, you know, I have to work at the loosely held bit, you know, because it's quite easy to keep your opinion and stay a bit entrenched, right? So
yeah, especially when you're right and you've been proven right over the years. let's not get into all that. It's not about who's right or wrong, but I completely agree. I think in every sort of realm of architecture, you know, you have to be open-minded, whether that's on technology, whether that's on process, whatever it may be.
because you don't know what you don't, nobody has all the answers. So it's all about having that growth mindset of actually active listening. Why are they thinking like that? Why are they saying that? Yeah, that actually works really, really well. Great. My opinion has now changed. Or it could be, no, I'm actually really, really right. Here's the reasons why I'm being able to demonstrate it. As long as you're able to demonstrate it and influence people, but again, you know, you've got to be able to put your reputation on the line and your opinions on the line from that perspective. And you know, I think this is where a lot of people get architecture wrong in some sense. And, you know, obviously I'm not an architect. I'm purely talking from a talent perspective, but I speak to hundreds every single week. And, you know, I come across people that come from a business background, business architect background, a software engineering background, or whatever it may be, an infrastructure background, security background. The good ones have got a common thread of being interpersonal, being able to hold conversation, being able to influence key stakeholders, and less much about the technology and so on and so forth. And they're the really good ones. I think the ones that sort of hit a glass ceiling, in my personal opinion, are the ones that stick with a particular type of technology and try to put square pegs into round holes based on that technology. And that does happen quite a lot. We see it a lot in businesses. So thanks very much.
Yeah, Rob. I just wanted to add to that. I think you're absolutely spot on. I think you've got, and this, you know, this isn't just architecture in tech, it's everything. You've got to remain tech curious. Because as you say, otherwise you kind of get stuck in a rut. So yeah, for sure.
100%. But caveat that with, you know, limit the magpie effect as much as you
can. Right. So you need to be understanding why you're looking at a particular technology. There needs to be this value driver behind it, because otherwise what's the point, right? You know, we're not doing this. Well, I know some people are doing it for the sake of it, but, you know, when we work in enterprises, we're not doing tech just because we like doing tech. Yeah. It's got to serve a, like, make the business more profitable or more cost efficient or whatever it happens to be. So, sure.
Yeah, agreed. 100%. And you know, if we could just delve into your architecture leadership career for a little bit. So tell us a little bit about, you know, the your leadership career in terms of the different stages, where you're at the moment, just to give a bit of context to the story, I suppose.
Actually, for probably most of my career, I've led, you mean like in terms of leading people, teams? So probably on and off for most of my career, I've led teams. Prior to consultancy, it would be the same team, you know, people that either I kind of recruited or inherited due to, I don't know, let's say organization restructures or whatever. So I think that that's a really important part of most senior technical roles is that leadership and mentorship. Sometimes, you know, there's that kind of formal people management aspect, you know, you're doing their appraisals, for example, you're setting their objectives, and sometimes it's perhaps less formal way of doing, you know, mentorship, where you've got younger, more junior members of staff who perhaps want somewhat objective help with how to progress their career and you know, unblocking things or giving a different perspective or whatever. So yeah, I mean, depending on what role, I've led teams of up to, I don't know, 12 people. That wasn't awesome because you obviously spend most of your time doing team management, but I think the ideal size for me at least is maybe 3 or 4 people.
Yeah, I think that's the general consensus, maybe a little sort of 5 to 6 direct reports as an absolute maximum. Obviously they might have 5 to 6 each themselves, and you sort of go and scale depending on size, but you know, there's not huge amounts of our large architecture teams out there. And I suppose that as you came through the ranks, what sort of challenges from a leadership perspective did you sort of encompass and
leadership perspective, I think certainly, I mean, it's loads better now, but when I started, you didn't get a lot of training in how to be a good people leader. It was, you know, apparently you would just magically know which was kind of awkward because learning on the job in that with people is not necessarily the best approach, is it? Because, you know, so I think over time, companies have recognized that there aren't any born leaders. You kind of have to be taught the right skills and ways of approaching challenging conversations, should we say. So I think that was one area. I hopefully have got somewhat better than I was back in the day, should we say. You know, I look back on some of the things and think, oh God. But so sorry, anyone that was led by me in the early days.
I think for me, as you come through into leadership roles and you know, bigger leadership roles, people I speak to, that the biggest thing is around the mindset and how your personal mindset has to change from, you know, in different scenarios. So initially, you know, it might be this person doesn't necessarily know what they're doing, so I need to be really hands-on, micromanaged, and then actually later on when they've mastered, not necessarily mastered that skill, but got better off on it, at it, sorry, you can, I suppose, release the reins a little bit and so on. Just, you know, without getting into the bell curve of management and so on and so forth. But just that mindset change of being able to recognize, right, that's what I need to do there. That's what I need to do there. It's less about me. It's more about them. You know, the whole thing becomes around, I'm no longer an individual contributor. I've got other people to think about now, and I need to get the best out of them. How do I get the best out of them? Your whole rhetoric changes, I suppose, internally. And I suppose from that, you've really got to understand where your strengths are as well, because then you're then going into, you know, we briefly touched on having your personal growth mindset around, how do I get better at handling those conversations? How do I get better at getting the best out of that person in that scenario and so on? So, yeah, that it's a whole different ball game.
I think you have to be very, so I think you're completely right. You need to sort of focus on setting up your team for success, each of the individual team members. And you have to be, I think, quite transparent and honest with them. And to be honest, I think even people where you think, oh, I'm going to have a bit of an awkward conversation about how they're performing or whatever, in the very large majority of people, they kind of already know that conversations coming along, you know, yeah. Over the years, every so often I've had to sit down with someone where it's like, look, you're not really kind of performing to the level I'd expect. And mm-hmm. almost without fail, this has not come as a surprise. So,
yeah,
which I think makes it a lot easier, because obviously if you have to explain to someone who thinks they're doing a brilliant job that they're not, that's kind of probably the worst scenario ever, right? But I rarely had to do that. But I think, you know, as you say, if you have someone that you need to kind of bring up levels or whatever, then sure, you have to focus on them more. But I think like setting the very clear objectives and expectations and making it, or at least for making it clear that, like, I think you're going to be able to do this, I expect you to do it, but if you get blocked or you're struggling, come and see me, because otherwise I'll assume that you're doing fine. So yeah, you know, rather
and
than
not
I, I'm not
on deadline day and say I'm struggling, like come to me,
yeah,
before,
exactly.
So I can actually help you and give me enough time.
Yeah.
Steve, for context, tell us a little bit about Vinathi Jet Stack then, and just because as we move into the next topic of conversation, it'll provide that context.
Okay. No worries. So has been around for about 8 or 9 years. It was started by a couple of guys called Matt, who used to work at MongoDB. They spotted the opportunity that Kubernetes seemed to present. So they started Jetstack. They started doing a lot of training, Kubernetes training. They work very closely with Google. So we provide Google with a lot of the Kubernetes training, so that if customers, you know, express interest in DKE or whatever, then quite often we'll be the ones that help them get up. And that actually kind of developed into consultancy services. So really, that's what JetStack specialize in, is cloud native and Kubernetes consultancy work. And then about 4 years ago, we were bought by a security company called Venafi. They do workload identity tools around, a lot of it's basically to do with certificate management. And one of the reasons they were attracted to JetStack is because we created something called Cert Manager, which for those in the kind of Kubernetes space, they should know and love as the kind of de facto tool for managing certificates in Kubernetes clusters. So that kind of was a natural fit for what Venafi were trying to do. They also kind of appreciate the value of the cloud native Kubernetes consultancy, which is why we're still kind of part of the Venafi group.
Okay. And your role over there as technical director, what does that entail on
So probably kind of three areas. So I do quite a lot of, let's call it, technical leadership. So, you know, not me on my own, but I certainly have to spend a lot of time figuring out what the next set of cloud native and Kubernetes related challenges customers are going to have, so that we can basically be in a position to have an opinion and have that expertise to be able to help them. I do work with customers directly, doing quite a lot of strategic advisory work, you know, where I'll go in and help them kind of scope out what their challenges are and what the solutions might look like, and then kind of leading the solution engineers that actually do the hands-on keyboard implementation work. And then finally, I do a lot of technical pre-sales.
Okay. So obviously, a lot of businesses, if not every single business in the world, wanted to move all their compute to cloud. In your experience, having met a bunch of customers, what's the general consensus as to why, or what are the key drivers behind why businesses are doing that? Because that will sort of segue us into what's actually going on then.
I think it is probably mostly to do with flexibility, because if you've got a data center, if you're running a data center or you're coloing in a data center, then typically the lead times for introducing new servers or kit into that data center are long, you know, like 6 months or more. Yeah. So, and also you've kind of got to plan almost for the worst case scenario. So it's like, I'm launching this new application. What do I think my peak load is going to be on that application? So you kind of almost need to have the server and other infrastructure in place to support that. And that's kind of so cloud is a super attractive way of not having to have those sorts of, to sort of have to think about that upfront. So you're kind of moving your CapEx into OpEx. So it's, I pay for what I use at the time. And that's great, because in theory, it should mean it's going to be cheaper for me. And also it means that I can flex. So if I know that, you know, suddenly I'm going to get a big popular thing happen, the resource will be there for me to sort of scale out. And then when that popular thing has died down, then I can scale back in again. And it also means that, and the final bit, I think, which is also super useful, is there is the cloud providers provide all sorts of services, you know, not just Kubernetes, not just compute, databases, HubSub, message queuing, or, you know, a huge variety of technologies. And for an individual company to be able to take advantage of all of those, to get that skill set to manage all of that, is just not really practical. So it gives them an opportunity to, you know, be flexible in what tools and tech.
Okay. And do you think businesses have reaped the rewards they intended by moving to the cloud? So you would have gone into businesses at the beginning of the cloud journey, and obviously you've nailed what they wanted, and, you know, you guys are great. But equally, you probably would have gone halfway through a transformation program or at the end of your transformation program to make a few tweaks. Again, in your experience, from what you see, have businesses reaped the rewards they intended by moving to the cloud?
Yes, I mean, they have, actually. I think that you have to go in with some, perhaps, maybe some of the expectations have not been quite so realistic. I think that mm-hmm. there's some, how can I put this? We had many years up until, let's say, the beginning of 2023, we had a very different mindset. We had a very much, it was a growth mindset. So the money taps were switched on and companies were very much focused on frankly growing at all costs, which yeah. meant that, and what that meant was that the focus on, let's say, controlling your cloud costs was not a priority. It was a priority mm-hmm. to sort of deliver more features, to deliver more stuff into the cloud, and to have mm-hmm. a platform engineering team and the developers and so on that could support all of that. And then, of course, things changed. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the grow at all costs kind of edict was replaced with, actually, we need to control our costs. And this was a very different yeah. mindset. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you've got CFOs going, so tell me about this really expensive team that you've got doing stuff in the cloud. How is that helping our business? You know, so I believe genuinely there have been quite a lot of awkward conversations. And suddenly okay. there's been this huge focus on, okay, we need to control our cloud costs. And we don't quite know how to do that because we've never had that discipline, needed to have that discipline. So we're doing quite a lot of work with customers on understanding where their costs are going in the cloud and what things they can do to make it more efficient. I mean, you know, I can't remember the exact stats, but like I think it's something like if you've got, let's say, a data center virtual machine will average out at maybe 10% efficiency if you're mm-hmm. if you're lucky, right? So that's 90% unused, rough average. And you would hope that in the cloud you get a lot better, but actually mm-hmm. the average efficiency of a Kubernetes node is probably only about 20%. So my point is there's a lot of room for cost savings, but you have yeah. to have that discipline and you kind of have to understand what things to tackle. And we've helped
and there's been changing. Sorry to interrupt, but you mentioned when we spoke previously that there's been a bit of a change, hasn't there, in terms of businesses used to do the whole you build it, run it and support it. Why did that not work? Yeah, why did that not work?
I think because, frankly, many developers and development teams first of all, they don't have the skills. Like mm-hmm. they're developers, they understand how to write code and design application architectures. They don't suddenly know how to provision, you know, securely and efficiently provision services in the cloud. They don't understand how to knit them together using infrastructure as code or how to automate it all. I mean, that's not really their job, but they were kind of expected to take that all on with that whole kind of shift left. Now, some developers really embraced it, but a lot of developers that I've worked with, you know, development teams or whatnot, just didn't really want to do it. They yep. did it as a thing, but they didn't have a great passion for it. So they kind of tried to spend as little time doing it as they could get away with because they wanted to write new features yep. and deploy them and stuff. So, yeah, in essence, I think that's why it's maybe not been as successful as people were expecting it to be.
So if you were to go into a business now as you know, Venafi or Jetstack Venafi, or even just as Steve Judge, as a advisor, a cloud advisor, what would you advise instead? What would you say, this is how we need to do it, this is how we're going to get you into whatever the cloud platform is? That's kind of irrelevant, but you know, let's assume we know what cloud platform, we know their challenges. How would you say we're going to get you into the cloud? What does that look like?
I think it's platform engineering team. For me, they're like the glue. So you know, back in the day, you had the development team, and you had like this operations team or this admin team, and it was literally throwing stuff over the fence.
Yep.
You know, almost literally. And clearly, that was not a great success either. You know, that whole meme works on my machine. I mean, you know, the truth, there's, you know, there's a lot of truth in those memes. But I think, so what you need, and frankly, this is how the large majority of companies are kind of doing this now, is they have a platform engineering team that basically kind of understand, and the development teams are almost their clients. So the platform engineering team is responsible for creating the infrastructure, for managing that infrastructure, and providing the development team, you know, with the means to create a let's call it an internal developer platform.
Yeah.
So the ultimate platforms are ones where you can kind of create some kind of self-service process, which could be as simple as an email or just raising a Jira ticket, or it could be a lot more sophisticated, like templates in Backstage or something. But the point is, the developer should not be given free rein to create whatever they like, particularly in the cloud. You want to give them some guardrails. So yes, if you want to create 10 MySQL databases, great. Here's the way to just request this happens, and we will give you the smallest number sort of fields that you have to fill in, and then all the security constraints and best practices that can be in effect hidden away because it's the platform engineering team, so that the developers don't have to worry about that stuff. They just know that they'll get their MySQL database.
Makes sense. Okay. And part of your role is understanding how cloud is sort of developing and the technologies around it and so on and so forth, but also what you feel from a technology leadership perspective, the new set of challenges are going to be. So, you know, if you had a crystal ball now, what do you think the businesses that are either in the cloud, going into the cloud, whatever it may be, what do you think their sort of next set of challenges they need to really think about before making any decisions are?
So I think businesses are starting to think more carefully about multi-cloud and hybrid environments.
Yep.
Without a doubt. And it's like, great. How do we make those interoperate? So for example, we're doing a project with a security company that have a SaaS product that used to run purely in AWS. And they've decided for some, you know, commercial reasons that they want to run it in GCP as well. So we're helping them migrate that so that it will run in both clouds. And clearly that means changing some of the underlying technologies that are being used. So we're removing the kind of AWS specific ones. It means changing ways of working and so on. So I think, and that also equally applies when you're kind of in a hybrid world where you know, you've got some data centers, you've got some cloud and so on. So I think, multi-cloud is definitely a thing that is now becoming much more talked about amongst, you know, not just the financial institutions that kind of have to do it for regulatory reasons, but also other organizations are starting to realize that will probably be a better strategy for their business as well. So there's that one. There's a little thing called AI, become quite popular. So where that particularly resonates with the stuff that I do is more about, because you've got lots of data science and machine learning teams that want to run those types of workloads in the cloud, because the cloud is a brilliant place to run it, right? I mean, you know, Google, Azure, AWS, they've all got GPU, TPU enabled compute instances. And so companies can't afford to buy their own compute instances, or the lead times are super long. So what a brilliant place to put it is in the cloud. And so there's a lot of thinking about and learning about how best to kind of utilize this compute in the cloud to run these sorts of workloads and help the data sort of analytics teams to kind of do this successfully. So I think, you know, those are the two top of mind areas.
Fine. Okay. And I don't know if you've heard about this, and they're very obviously most, what they say, 80% of percentages and statistics are made up. So, you know, bear with me on this one, but I read a Forbes article, couple of weeks ago, and it mentioned 82 or 84% of digital transformation programs have failed. Now, you know, again, that's a loose term. That might be failed against the original objective, and the world moves on, technology moves on, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, that was the headline that got me to read the article. Now, it might not be 82, 84%. It might be a lot lower, but we know that a lot of digital transformation programs do fail. And part of digital is cloud. You know, a big part of digital actually is cloud recently, certainly over the past sort of, as you said, 5 to 10 years. Why, in your opinion, why do you think most transformation programs, digital transformation programs fail? And in your world, you could make that specifically around cloud if you want.
Yeah, because I'll be honest, if you count every single digital transformation, I mean, just look at Birmingham City Council and their kind of Oracle transformation, you know, which is clearly an abject failure. That's got nothing to do with the cloud. But I think perhaps there are similar sort of lessons, which is you need to be really clear on what your scope is and what your requirements are. I mean, and up front, you have to make some quite serious decisions. So if you've got a big estate on-prem, you need to really carefully look at that estate and decide, okay, of this estate, what applications am I going to abandon because there's just they're no longer needed? What applications just aren't possible to move because it would just be ridiculously impractical to try and move them? Then of the remaining left, it's like, all right, what applications can we just lift and shift? Like literally just take it and move it into cloud. And then what applications do we need to cloud optimize? And it's quite hard doing that. If you've got a very large, especially the larger, I mean, a small organization, perhaps easier because you've got a limited estate. But if you've got a large sprawling enterprise, it gets really difficult to make those decisions because, you know, it's quite hard to say, no, we don't need that application. You might still have two people using it for some reason. And then the same with the kind of whole lift and shift is, and you know, I've talked to clients in the past where they literally just lifted and shifted and they've realized that they've kind of made life a bit more difficult for themselves. It's, you know, and really what they should have done is a bit of cloud optimization as part of the migration. But then this is where you have to be really clear on what that scope looks like, because it's very easy to go, oh, don't really like that little bit. I'll just go in and change how that particular part of the application works. And then all of a sudden, 2 months have gone and you haven't quite succeeded because you didn't really understand what it did. And now you've made it worse. So I think, you know, it's like anything. It's you if you bite off more than you can chew and you kind of just double on down, and then all of a sudden you come up for air and 2 years have passed.
100%. Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for that. So we're going to move on to our quick fire questions now as we're coming towards the end of the episode. So first one, what advice do you wish you received early on in your career?
I think that make the most of your capacity to learn and acquire new skills. As the older you get, the harder it is. So I'm, let's just say, in my mid-50s, and it is somewhat more difficult to just kind of, like, if I try and learning a new programming language now, as opposed to when I was in my 20s, it is noticeably more difficult to do so. And when I was in my 20s, I just thought, I can learn everything. I'm just like a sponge. And I wish I still was, but so that's the knowledge.
To be more like a sponge earlier on. Fine. Okay. Yeah. What's the hardest interview question you've ever had?
Oh, God. Yeah. So this was such a weird one. I was interviewed by a company that I think they did like online mortgages or something. And it was a tech interview, like a whiteboard problem. And the guy sat there and said, imagine a two-dimensional container with an irregular bottom, you know, like that. Describe the algorithm to calculate the area of empty space in this container. And I was just looked at him and I said, I have no idea how to do that. And it just went downhill from there on, because I was just like, why are you asking me this weird question? And he got really upset, because he was very proud of this question. He clearly spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I just genuinely couldn't understand what he was trying to achieve with it. Anyway, the interview didn't go well.
So, you didn't get the job. Otherwise, you would have remembered the name of the business, right? You would have worked for it. So what advice would you give a newly appointed chief architect?
Back to something I said near the beginning of this chat, was have strong opinions, but hold them loosely and learn. But so that's part one. And the other part is learn to communicate technical concepts to people who are much less technical than you are, because you're going to have to influence a whole raft of people, many of whom are product people or finance people or salespeople or whatever, and they don't particularly, and why should they, have a huge technical background. So the onus is on you to kind of be able to describe the technical challenge or the solutions in a way that will they'll understand and will resonate with them.
Okay, makes absolute sense. What's the biggest change you expect to see in the market over the next 5 years from a talent perspective?
Greater diversity. I think, you know, progress is being made. There needs to be more, clearly. And that, frankly, starts at school and universities, I think, to be honest. And I think it's the onus is on the larger enterprises to be able to kind of exert some influence to make that happen. So that's one thing. I think over the next year or so, there will be a more realistic employer-employee dynamic. So prior to 2023, the pendulum was most definitely on the employee side, way too far. And then 2023 meant that pendulum shifted way over to the employer side, too far. So I'm hopeful that it will start to kind of swing back into the middle.
In equilibrium, makes absolute sense. Absolutely. Yeah, we've seen that in the sort of recruitment industry as well. Because obviously we see things first, don't we, from that perspective, from a talent perspective. So yeah, I completely agree. Well, sadly, Steve, we've run out of time. It's been really interesting and a great to chat with you in detail about architecture, cloud computing. So thank you so much for your time. An excellent podcast episode and giving us your time today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem. It was good speaking to you.
Awesome. Thanks, Steve. Thank you.
Cheers.
And that's a wrap. Sadly, we're at the end of another Transformational Blueprints episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it and there were plenty of golden nuggets for you to take away. If you're a fan of the show, please do remember to share, like, and leave reviews so that more people from our industry get to hear and benefit from these too. Please also follow Synaxia Group on LinkedIn to keep up to date with new episodes. Links in the show notes. Join us next time for another episode packed with tips and advice from senior leaders in the technology world.